Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Met and Musings. My name is Misty Garcia, and I'm your host tonight. Tonight, we will be discussing meditation and what that is and how it can help you. Our special guest is going to be Jeffrey Rutstein, so let me get him on the line with us just one moment here. Hello, Jeffrey. Are you there?
I am, Misty. I am right here. Hi.
Hi, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. I'm so excited to discuss meditation with you tonight.
It's my pleasure, and I'm excited too to talk with you.
Yes. So I just kind of wanted to start with, you know, let us know who you are, what you do, and kind of how you discovered meditation.
Okay, so I was a really anxious child, and I probably had some spiritual leanings, but I had a tremendous amount of personal agony in how anxious and worried I was. And there really wasn't drugs that they would give to kids back then.
Yeah.
So I found a yoga book on my mom's shelf in the library.
Mm-hmm.
Library, it was two bookcases. And I took this down, and I've told this story before, but she begins when she talks about her training to be, she was the first Caucasian woman, first Caucasian woman to be trained as a yoga teacher in, I think, the late 40s and early 50s as a Westerner. And she was talking about how, you know, one of yoga's principles is non-harming. And she had ants in her little hut that she was living in, and she was going to have to call an exterminator, you know. And so she said to the ants, if you go outside, I'm going to put three sugar cubes outside for you every day. And otherwise, I'm going to have someone come and, you know, not be nice to you. And so she put the three sugar cubes out, and from that day forward, from the next day forward, there were no ants in her hut.
Really?
And yeah, and so, like, to an 11-year-old brain, this was like magic. This was sorcery. And I thought, okay, any woman who can talk to ants and get them to listen has really got to be kind of special. And so I read and started teaching myself yoga, in particular pranayama, breathing exercises, and doing breath meditation. And that was my first practice for a bunch of years until I actually then formally started taking yoga. And I took that for a bunch of years until I was 17, 18, and then I found my Zen teacher, and I studied with him very actively from like 78, 79 until the late 90s. And then he was too sick to travel, and I was getting busy with family, not being able to go back and study in California. And so found another teacher after that named Abhyashanti, who I've been following, especially online and reading and live teaching broadcasts, which just makes it, you know, really easy to stay connected to a teacher and keep learning. So I started out trying to get rid of my anxiety, but it opened up a whole other world of possibilities.
Wow, that is an amazing story. So you've been practicing for a really long time, since you were a child.
Yeah, well, I just turned 60, so I've been practicing for 49 years.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So you still follow, is it how do you say your teacher's name now? Ozzy Shanti?
Adya Shanti.
Adya.
But he's the main teacher. Adya Shanti is the main teacher I follow right now.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, I'm also a psychologist, and I was trained very classically as a psychologist, and I actually took training as a psychoanalyst and spent years doing that, and I still have a psychology practice, but over the years I've begun blending them more and more because I see how contemplative approaches are really so, so important to helping people change the way that they're living, and in particular, sort of get out of their own way of creating their own suffering and trouble.
Yes. I do love how you said kind of helping people to overcome that self-created suffering. So that's what meditation is helpful for. And the reason I'm kind of going to make this to people who are just now learning about meditation, you know, they really are learning about it and they're not sure what it is or how it can help them. So do you have like some basics of, you know, what meditation is and how it can help, you know, in a general basis?
So there's two major distinctions in traditional meditation. There's what's called closed or concentrative meditation, and then open meditation. And a closed or concentrative meditation is a meditation where you learn how to focus the mind single-pointedly on an object of concentration, whether that's the breath or a mantra or a prayer or a phrase or an image. You know, it could be an image of a deity, or it could be an image of Christ or Buddha or Muhammad, or it could be any of these intricate mandalas, which are very symmetrical visual designs that are designed to actually help bring the mind through vision to a state of focus. And there's hundreds or thousands of schools that practice the closed meditation form.
Right.
And then there's open meditation, which actually starts with closed meditation. You first learn how to concentrate, but then once you've learned how to concentrate, you sort of take that kind of awareness, that kind of presence, and you bring it to anything and everything you're doing, so that instead of just your breath or a mantra or a prayer being your object of meditation, brushing your teeth, walking to the car, playing with your dogs, eating dinner, having a conversation, can all be places where you bring that same sense of attention and presence and being to whatever you're doing.
Wow, and so that is like like awareness practice, correct?
Yes.
Like becoming aware, okay.
Now, today there's also some things that are called meditation which are much more like what I would consider like visualizations or guided relaxations, you know, where they have you imagine a journey and you're going to a mountain and you learn things, or you know, it sort of places you somewhere in your imagination. Hypnosis is a little bit like this. And I personally don't really term them meditation, at least in the way that I had originally been introduced to meditation. I was introduced to it as a way of formally training the mind in paying attention, specific benefit of liberating the individual from the cycle of self-created suffering. And a lot of guided imagery meditations and hypnotic-like meditations bring some relief, but don't really help you get closer to unraveling the mechanism that keeps creating struggle and strife in your life.
Right. So it's more of like a distraction, those types, than it is a solution.
Yes. A distraction and a momentary soothing. And they can be quite pleasant, and people can get relaxed from them. But then you come out of it, and you're still in your life, and you still may not know quite what to do with it, except you feel a little bit more relaxed because you had just done this, you know, journey, this relaxation journey.
Right. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Now, for someone who, because I've heard a lot of people, for me, I've only just learned about meditation recently, so like a couple years actually. And I know when I first started, it was extremely hard for me to even sit still for 2 minutes. And I hear a lot of people who are starting meditation talk about how, well, I can't meditate. I can't sit still that long. I can't focus on anything that long. Do you have any kind of suggestions or ideas for anyone who's just now starting?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, it's really helpful to get good instruction. Because if you're just told to sit and be quiet and not think, you're going to have a lot of problems. You're going to feel very frustrated, and you can't possibly stop thinking. And when they say clear your mind, the vast majority of people who need meditation the most won't have the foggiest idea about how to clear their mind. They'll know, I should get rid of something, but they don't know how to get rid of it or what to get rid of.
Yes.
And so, for example, when I teach meditation, I speak about the idea that you're not trying to stop thoughts. Thoughts are the natural process of how your mind works. What we're simply trying to do is to cultivate the ability to not be so hijacked and captured by our thinking, instead be able to deliberately and intentionally shift our awareness more towards exactly what's happening in the present moment. So, for example, we often use the breath as an object of focus, both because it's portable, but also because it's sensation. And so if you're paying attention to sensation, it's only happening in the present moment. You're not going to be remembering what it felt like to breathe 3 minutes ago. You're going to be feeling what it feels like to breathe in this very moment. And so the moment you begin paying attention to sensations, you're already beginning to come out of a trance of thinking, and you're beginning to enter into being more present. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, people can only sit for a few minutes in the beginning because there's a lot of habit behind the way that we think and we feel antsy. But also, a lot of times, people aren't instructed about then how to deal with the distractions, like when you start thinking again, which you will, or when you're back aches or your knees ache or you start getting an itch or you find that you're fidgety or, you know, your leg is falling asleep or whatever. There's ways of working with these instead of getting back into a fight about, oh, I got to move my leg or I have to pretend like it's not killing. And either of those ways are not really helpful or skillful ways of working. You know, there's also the idea that for some people, moving meditation may be a little bit more easy to access initially than sitting still meditation. So, for example, Tai Chi, this ritualized set of movements that's done very slowly and with a lot of awareness devoted to actually feeling the sensations of moving into the postures, holding the postures, and then moving from one posture into the next posture. Yoga is another example. There's also something called like mindful walking, just paying attention to the act of walking. And this actually can be done as a meditation. So for especially hyperactive kids who are interested in learning something about meditation, we'll often start with something that's moving. But there's a lot of adults who come with that kind of tendency also. And really sitting still is almost feels like sitting on pins and needles. So then we might start with a moving meditation to help begin to get them into learning about how working with your attention can change how you feel. And as they begin to get that, we introduce them seated meditation, where they're able to then take the skill and transfer it over. I do think people can get a tremendous benefit from moving meditation, but I think that if you, again, like, so I know I'm answering several things at once. So meditation has benefits and rewards based on how you use it. So at the very least, meditation can help your body learn how to calm down and your mind to become less noisy. And that is a lot of relief for a lot of people, just at the psychological level or at the stress level.
Yes, yes.
And then there's another layer of learning how to be. In other words, most of us are human doings instead of human beings. And so we spend our life always doing, either physically doing or mentally doing, by planning what we're going to do or by rehashing what we've done and wanting it to be a little better or a little different, or being bored with what we're doing now and looking forward to what we can do next. And
yeah,
that's all about time, either projecting into the future, going back to the past. It's not about being right here. And
mm-hmm.
being, the quality of being, is the quality of being able to be present, being in this moment. And we hear a lot of talk about, we need to be present, and, you know, being more present helps you, but then people, well, how do I be present? Well,
right.
Meditation is actually a structured way of helping people learn to cultivate that skill.
Wow, yeah.
And then,
sorry, I just want to ask you a quick question about that. So
sure.
When they cultivate that skill, is that something that when they do feel like you're in the moment, you're in the day, and you feel
mm-hmm.
your mind start to get away with you, can you learn to come back to the present moment? Is that part of it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So part of it is learning that we aren't our thoughts.
Yes.
For many of us, we live so much inside of the world of our thoughts that we believe them to be true, and we kind of even don't live in the real world. Like, I love the analogy of The Matrix. Did you see the movie?
Yes, I love that movie.
Right, me too. So, you know how all these humans were asleep in these pods, and their body heat was keeping the machine that had taken over the world alive. It was sort of, you know, running, it was a battery for the machine, so to speak. And these people
yeah.
who were asleep in their pods were dreaming of having a life. But
mm-hmm.
they weren't, they thought they were having a life, but they were in this pod asleep. And
yeah.
that's kind of like how most of us are. We are living through this lens, this sleepwalking through life of through our thoughts and plans and concepts and labels and thinking and worrying and ruminating and all of those things. And we think that's all of life. And instead, we're living life, you know, between our ears, instead
yeah.
of actually out in the world. And at the further reaches of meditation, it's about learning how to wake up completely from the sleepwalking dream that most people live in.
Yes.
So you can undertake meditation to feel a little less stressed and to feel more relaxed. You can undertake it to find a way to pull yourself out of when you get lost in negative cycles of thought, upsetting thought, upsetting emotion, and you can even keep taking it and so that you can embody this level of awareness where you've sort of ended the cycle of self-created self.
Yeah.
And where you're showing up as basically very calm, open, loving space.
Yeah.
That people who practice a long time in their life, you get that feeling from when you're with them, that there's this depth and peace and inner quiet in them. Not like they're withdrawn from the world and not like they're always one-dimensional or just flat, but that they're less noisy and less jumpy in their own self. And if you're around people like that, you kind of pick up that vibe.
Yeah, it radiates. It does.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
Definitely. Just like with you, for those that are listening to the podcast, I actually started watching Jeffrey on Periscope, and you can see your peacefulness through Periscope. And I find that amazing, like just being around or even watching certain people who have that peace that radiates from them, you can just see it and feel it immediately.
Yes. Yes, that's very true. That at the levels of where we begin to be peace, be spaciousness, be centered, be awake and loving, that your mere presence is offering something to the world, because you become an invitation for others to resonate with and find that same space inside themselves. And the teachers that I've been lucky enough to study with have been people that have a massive And I'm not talking about like a charismatic presence, like larger than a room or something like that. These are very simple, very plain human beings that just emanate a kind of palpable presence, a kind of palpable openness and being fully here, fully with you, fully in this moment, not torn in a thousand different directions, not having an agenda of, you know, getting something from you or something from the world. And that always spoke to me very deeply, deeper than words did, actually. That's really what I looked for in my teachers, was this alignment with this quality of being.
Yes, yes. Somebody was saying on Periscope that people notice that you can, like, you see them when you can actually see someone, and not for their outside appearance, I'm assuming, but, you know, see who they really are, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I feel that's partly also because I was blessed to be a psychologist. And so, you know, I've spent thousands and thousands and thousands of hours with people in therapy. And so, you know, between the two, I think that they both train you to sort of be sensitive to sensing other people. But, yeah, I think that even if you're not a psychologist and you just practice meditation and presence, you'll find that you're really able to receive people and see people as they are instead of as your projections of them might be.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I totally get that. Like an avatar, someone said. Yes, like an avatar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yes.
I was actually wondering, since I've only been doing meditation for, you know, just really new to it, for me, there has been moments in my meditation practice where I've gotten to that, you know, blissful, peaceful state, and I'm sure it's nowhere near what, you know, some others have reached in their lifetime. But it feels like once you reach that, then you're always trying to get back to that. Does it ever get better, like, the more you practice? Are you there more often?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Well, okay. Yeah. So yeah, it makes perfect. So here's where it gets a little bit more down the rabbit hole, but we'll try this in it. So what you're describing is almost universal with people who begin some kind of a spiritual practice. Is that by hook or by crook, by a long amount of practice, or by the grace of God, or because they had a head cold, all of a sudden they do some practice and they tap into a bliss. They tap into this ease, warm, spacious, loving, calm, you know, really lovely, delicious place. And then, every time they practice after that, they want to get back to it. And they judge every practice its success on whether or not they get back to it. And what's happening then is you're no longer practicing being present, but actually practicing trying to recapture an experience. And so that actually becomes the very thing that gets in the way of people accessing those states again, is because instead of being present and just dropping into it naturally, we're trying to chase or recreate something that we have a memory of that we experienced last week or last month or yesterday, and we're actually not being in our bodies and minds right now. We're trying to go back to a state that's not here right now. And then we start using meditation in the way that we use most of our life, which is to try to get something so we feel better.
Yes.
The other thing is that, you know, the way that I practice and the way that I was taught is that, I'm not chasing after bliss. I'm instead trying to simply be present. And that means not fighting and not resisting whatever is coming up. So if I have a stomachache, that's coming up. If the sun is shining and it's beautiful, that's coming. If I'm feeling energetic and happy, that's coming. If I'm feeling sad and worn down, that's coming. So that part of the training is in not preferring. And the moment you stop preferring another moment over this one, you've already taken a step towards being free.
Yeah, definitely.
And that way, if you're present, and you're present to your legs aching, then you're present to your legs aching. And if you're present and you have this feeling of bliss streaming through you, well, that's cool. You're having this feeling of bliss streaming. But part of this contemplative way of approaching life is also realizing nothing stays. Nothing is permanent. So
yes,
any lovely state is going to pass, and any horrible state is going to pass. And part of it is not just knowing better, thinking that, but it's actually, this is part of what practice gives you. When you practice being present to yourself day after day, you start seeing that some days you're really great and some days you're not so great. Some days, you know, you feel on top of the world and some days you don't. But that no matter what mood you're in, the moods never last.
Right.
Maybe, you know, they last hours, days, or weeks, but then they shift, then they change. Just like any pain that you're in, even chronic pain, is never identical every single moment. It's always changing in some fashion. It may not disappear, but the intensity and the flavor, the style, the direct experience of the pain is always morphing and shifting.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody said, so basically stop trying to get somewhere in your practice, you know? Yeah, so that's exactly right.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
You know, my teacher Aji will say that true meditation involves getting rid of the meditator and getting rid of the effort to meditate, or relaxing the meditator, letting them go off duty, and relaxing the effort to get somewhere.
Nice. Wow. That's powerful, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And I like
and
how...
that's very different,
Yeah, it is. It is a different perspective of how to look at things. And
yeah.
I like how you were stating that, you know, letting things come up as they are. So if you're feeling sad or you're feeling angry, sitting with that, you know, not trying to make it a good, you know, a happy experience or a blissful experience, but sitting with whatever you're feeling in that moment. Correct?
Right. Yes. And then we tweak that a little bit by saying that, so you're angry and you're coming to a moment of practice. You're going to sit down with anger. And what we advise is you turn your attention towards how this anger is showing up in the body.
Yes.
Meaning, like, you know, my fists are clenching, my stomach's kind of in a knot, I feel my jaw clamping down, and I can feel this burning in my chest and my solar plexus, my shoulders are tight. And you stay there instead of going into the story. If you go back into the story, well, she or he did this, and they said this, and they were promising this, and they did that instead, what happens is, you know, it's a mechanism that just keeps stirring up the activation in the body. And so if you're trying to meditate or trying to be present to something, but all you're doing is reviewing the story, then all you're doing is you keep throwing gas on the fire.
Yes.
But on the other hand, if you let go of the story, if you don't keep investing and repeating it and trying to be right, if you just come to, okay, how does anger feel in my body right now? And you tune to exactly how it's taking up resonance in your muscle and in your organ.
Mm-hmm.
And you just work with paying attention to that. You'll notice that it morphs. It gets a little more intense. It gets a little less intense. And eventually, it dissipates. Sometimes it goes away totally, and sometimes people are really happy about that, or then they go back into the story and they stir it all up again.
Yes.
And then you can work with it again to sort of dissolve it by going towards the body sensation and just breathing with the body sensation. You can actually learn how to work with anger or fear or impatience or jealousy or craving or longing. You can work with any state.
Yes, and I have noticed in my practice, and this might be helpful for somebody who's just starting out, that initially when I was feeling in my body was like my throat would feel tight, or, you know, my stomach would feel tight, like I would feel tightness in parts of my body, and that, I mean, that's how it's starting for me. So it can be really subtle because we're not used to paying attention to our body that way. You know what I mean? We're not used to noticing oh, my throat feels tight, or my stomach feels tight, or, you know, whatever it is. And when I start to pay attention to that and notice it dissipating, it's a really neat experience. And you can notice it more during your everyday life as well once you start noticing it in meditation, I think.
Exactly. Meditation gives you the ground for being able to experience things in a way where your attention is actually on what's occurring in you instead of on your narration of what's occurring in you, or instead of what you're planning next or worrying about. Instead, it actually lets you see that if you are with certain experiences, they come and go. They don't overtake you. And that you actually have a power to not feed them. We're not taught this in school. And we're taught that we're responsible for our feelings. And if you're feeling sad, well, it's your problem, and you need to pick yourself up by the bootstraps. And if you're feeling anxious, well, that's your problem. And, you know, a lot of therapy would be devoted to, okay, let's go into the narrative about why you're so afraid of loss or being left. And that's helpful, but it doesn't stop someone from being afraid.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
What it does is it gives us a better story about it, and maybe we can intervene and go, oh, I'm afraid right now because of this, and we may be able to try to calm ourselves down a bit. That's one very valid way of working with it. The meditative system looks at things very differently and looks at that out of habit and out of wiring, we create a lot of noise in our own brains, all humans do, and that this noise is largely responsible for the majority of our suffering.
Yes. Yes, our minds, well, I know for me, I can't speak for everyone, but for myself, I notice that my mind will run. I mean, it will take one simple, thought, and it can create this whole huge turmoil that hasn't even happened yet in a second.
Absolutely.
And
right.
And I think that does cause a lot of suffering for a lot of people. And once we become aware of that, for me, once I became aware of that, it's an everyday practice. So it's not like, you know, one practice is going to help you stop it all the time. But now I can notice it in my everyday life. I can go, oh, wait a second. I'm starting to run away again. Let me take a step back, or let me bring myself back to the present.
And Misty, you're already then a significant way on the path, because you've actually been able to observe in yourself this tendency to sometimes totally believe these projected catastrophes. Mark Twain had a line that said something like, in my life, I've lived through many horrible things, a few of which actually occurred.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I love that. Absolutely.
Meaning that most of it was just, you know, oh, I worried about this. Oh, that didn't. Well, I worried about that. And worry, universally, we know this from brain science, right? When the part of the brain that's responsible for worry and anxiety and fear is switched on, anyone who is switched on will start thinking about the future in ways that have a catastrophic or really negative outcome. Like whenever you're worried, you're not worried that, you know, tomorrow you're going to get $10 million. You're worried that you're going to get sick, someone you love will die. You'll lose your job. This bad thing will happen. You know, the world will come to an end. So individual people have their own particular thing or content to worry about. But what the brain is doing when it worries is universal across all humans. It's always about the future, and it's always about something bad happening.
Definitely true. I had a question in Periscope for you, Jeffrey. Someone was asking, do you consider journeying a meditation? And I'm assuming they mean like a astral kind of traveling, like journeying in their meditation. Is that right? If you're still on Periscope.
I'm assuming it could either be shamanic journeying, or you know, trance journeying, or a meditative projection, like either astral projection or something like that. I don't consider journeying a meditation from the way that I'm defining meditation. I'm not saying that journeying isn't useful or helpful or even healing for people. But journeying itself, while it may bring you insight, both spiritual insight and psychological insight, an insight about how things work and about how energies are, it will not necessarily better prepare you about how to be present, because it's not training attention. And so, again, I just want to say this, that, you know, like, I'm not saying one is better than the other. What I am saying is that if your goal is to be able to be more awake, more calm, more loving, more present than your life, to be able to feel like you can live your life instead of either observing it or being swamped by worry and anxiety and anger and feelings, then the meditation in the way that I'm talking about meditation, especially the open style of meditation, is, I think, one of the major paths towards cultivating that capacity.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think in regards to, like, shamanic journeying, it's not that that's not helpful and you can't learn a lot from shamanic journeying. It's just that in the focus of being present and learning how to bring yourself back to the present moment to stop self-induced, pain, then that's probably not the best one for bringing you to the present. But I know a lot of people have come to realizations with journeying, for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Deep insights and realizations and understandings about why you might have pain, and understanding that perhaps another life, there's something unfinished, is impacting this one. And that can be useful information for some people. That can be useful.
Yeah.
For me, you know, I say this often, and I don't want to sound arrogant with this, but what I'm really interested in is truth. And the kind of truth I'm interested in is, okay, what is the truest, deepest, most realist and authentic aspect of being human?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what got me started on this level of the path is, what are we really here for? What is this life about? Is it just to acquire things and to learn things and to marry and procreate and then die? I mean, certainly there's no shame in that. But it felt to me like we're missing the boat if we think that's all there is. And,
right.
You know, I was raised Jewish, there was a very strong belief in the family, and we were observant. We went to synagogue, and, you know, I felt it comforting, and I felt it nourishing to a point, but it didn't do anything to help me train my attention. It didn't do anything to help me be more present. It did help me to learn and do some things, like I think a lot of religions can, about how to be good people in the world, about how to, you know, think about treating other people with kindness and the golden rule, and to love and to be kind and to have a sense of moral values. And that's good. But to me, I was especially intrigued about hearing stories of people waking up. Once I heard about enlightenment, and I got a sense that there's actually a possibility in this lifetime for human beings to be what I would call, like, fully developed, fully mature. Not just psychologically mature, not just chronologically mature, but spiritually mature as well, fully mature. And to me, enlightenment is the full blooming of the full potential of the human.
Yes, yes. And correct me if I'm wrong, but to be enlightened, it's not just about one of those aspects. I mean, it's a whole physical, mental, and spiritual combination of developing all of those, correct?
Well, depends on who you talk to. So right now you're talking to me, so I'll tell you what I
Okay,
so the fact is that many traditions will say that enlightenment perfects the view but not the personality. Actually, in particular, Stephen Levine said that. But many teachers, many writers have said that. That you can get a deep insight into the nature of reality. You can have very deep spiritual awakenings, and you could be mostly enlightened or enlightened a good deal of the time. But if you haven't also worked directly with the ego, then you can get a very spiritualized ego that, if you remember, there were these teachers, yoga teachers and meditation teachers back in the 90s and 2000s, that it came out that they were having sexual relations with female and male students.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was, and to many people, that was a sign that these people who were revered as teachers were not over themselves. And they took their power and they used it inappropriately for their own gratification. You know, for me, I'm interested, in the whole package. I don't want just the view being perfected. I want to be able to be mature and fully developed across my entire humanness. So that it's not just that I have a very clear view of reality, but that I also have a sense of my own shadow self and also learning how to not be so operating and so identified with the personal self.
Yes. And I think that's something, speaking of the shadow self, that most, I see it a lot in spirituality, but it's like we always have to be happy all the time and be like vibrant and everything sunshine and lollipops. But really, you know, sitting with your shadow side and sitting with some of the dark things that we go through is part of becoming whole, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, like, for example, I'm sick. I have a chronic illness, and I have, gone through some major bouts of serious illness with it, and there's been considerable, years worth of considerable pain. And at the same time, it has been my best teacher.
Yes.
It has been my best teacher about impermanence, about working with pain, about the way that we define ourselves and the stories that we tell ourselves, so that I wouldn't have as deep access as I do now had I not been gifted with getting ill.
Yeah.
So I think that pain is one of our best teachers. That's not to say that people should go out and, like, you know, jump off a cliff to, you know, stimulate a spiritual awakening, you know, but that there's plenty of pain that we're faced with all the time. There's plenty of discomfort that we're faced with all the time. And most of us try to distract ourselves from it. Numb ourselves to distract ourselves instead of turning towards it, facing it, not drowning it, not wallowing it, but turning and being with it.
Absolutely. Definitely. And I think that is definitely what meditation can help people do, correct? Once you start practicing, it can help people shift their perspective and shift into that being thankful for, you know, what is happening in the moment, even if it isn't sunshine and lollipops, right?
Right. And there may be times when you can't be grateful in the moment because you're in too much pain, you're in too much grief, your heart is too broken. But you will start finding that as you pay attention in these ways, you begin to find that there's a natural sense of abiding gratitude for the things that are being provided for you in life.
Yes.
And again, part of this is, you know, if we're always coming from the egoic self, from the normal identity space, that self is also a large collection of habits about always picking and choosing something better than what's ever here. And so as long as we're kind of mostly identified with the ego and the thinking storyteller, we're always going to be somewhat dissatisfied and think things could be better. Always.
Right.
And that's kind of not going to ever put you in gratitude unless you get what you want, which is once in a great while. On the other hand, if you become present, you become awake to what's happening, and if you're living from this place of sort of saying yes to the present moment, you start finding more and more that you have an appreciation for the way the sunlight comes through the trees, and the way that the dog is breathing in the background, and the way that the water feels on your lips, and how comfortable the chair is after you've been walking for a while. And instead of focusing on how much your feet hurt, you focus on the pleasure of being able to have done the walk and now the opportunity to rest. It's not having a different life. It's relating to the life, to this life, from a different place.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because we've got about 15 minutes left, so I just want to touch base with how people can get in touch with you, and that's at your website, correct, at drjeffreyrutstein.com, correct?
Yes. Yes. www.drjeffreyrutstein.com. I have two free meta meditations there. Those are meditations to develop compassion and kindness towards self and others, and they're free download. You just give your email address. But if you do that, you'll also be on a list that if I offer other live or online trainings, you'll get notified of them because I do them pretty frequently, and then I send those out to the list.
Awesome. So they can download a couple of free meditations and then also be on your email list for upcoming events, correct? That's awesome.
Right. Exactly. So, and if they have a specific question or want to get knowledgeable about something specific, there's also a contact form at the bottom of almost every page. They can just fill that out. It actually turns into an email, and it's them emailing me directly.
Fantastic. And if somebody is wanting to start a meditation practice or they're wanting to look for a teacher, do you teach? And then can you teach long distance?
Yeah, I do teach long distance, and I do a lot of online teaching.
Okay.
I actually do a little bit more online teaching now than I do live teaching, just because it's so convenient and easy.
Right.
And it's very enjoyable. But I like doing both. And so, yeah, if people are interested, I do. That's all that I teach, basically, online, on ways of becoming more embodied and more present, and more awake to your life.
Awesome. And there was a question on Periscope about the difference between the silent meditation and then the guided and mantra meditation.
Right. So, we offer, usually I offer people guided meditations in the beginning where I'm helping them, reorient back to their breath, to their body, towards watching thoughts. And that's a very good beginning practice. Along the way, we start encouraging people to stop using the guided tapes and to experiment on their own. And people, find that actually after they practice a little while with these guided meditations about this specific kind of meditation, that they're able then to do it on their own without the guidance. And if they're having a rough patch or if they're really upset or anxious, they go back and they use a guided meditation because it helps focus them and bring them back in.
Right.
I think that, it's all about the quality of the guided meditation. And again, a lot of people sell things and call things guided meditations where I may not quite see them or consider them to be meditations in the way that I'm talking about. Again, I'm talking about meditation as a way of training the attention to become more aware of itself. And there are guided meditations that are more kind of like journeys, distractions, relaxations, imagery, guided imagery kinds of things. So
right.
Those can be good and relaxing, but they won't be the same thing as learning eventually how to be present to your own life. And ultimately, sitting, learning in silence, that's a very powerful way. Something I've also been teaching more lately in the last couple of years is actually about directly accessing presence. Because I find that there can be a lot of people who practice meditation for a number of years and don't really get any closer to waking up. They don't really get a lot of experience with what it's like to be without thought. And so these presencing exercises, and there's several people that are teaching them. Locke Kelly is another person who teaches this, and I've listened to a lot of his teachings. I've read some of his books. They're very, very good. He was a student of Adyashanti, and he's also a psychotherapist. And he also offers trainings in this kind of work where you try to give people glimpses into what being present and awake is like. And so I've done a few of these on Scope. I did one of my last courses, the most recent course, was Poetry and the Practice of Presence, where we used a poem and then used some of these practices as a way of immediately dropping into spacious, awake awareness. And
nice.
That can happen without years of meditation. Now, it may take you months and years to learn how to live more and more from there. But you start off with beginning to get glimpses of, oh, that's what it's like not to be thinking. Oh,
yeah.
That's what it's like when I'm not filtering everything through judgment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know.
Yes, and it's a daily practice too, right? Because, you know, I can feel myself when I don't practice, you know, for like a few days or a week, I can feel myself going back to my old habits, my old habitual ways of thinking and waking, in my waking life. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Exactly.
So it is something, and that's kind of how I viewed it, as a muscle. So when I first started, it would be like only 2 minutes. And then
right.
It became 5 minutes, and then it became 20 minutes. And then if I stop doing it for a while, I have to go back to like 5 or 10 minutes because
mm-hmm.
I haven't done it for a while.
Right. And also because until you get to a certain state of awakening, you'll find that the force of habits will begin to pull you back. So
yes.
I don't have to do formal practice every day, in terms of I don't have to sit on my cushion every day. But at this point in my life, I'm practicing most of the day anyway. In other words, I'm living my life as an opportunity to be present. I'm not always successful at it. I can still get caught up in thought and hijack my moods. But this is my work on a moment-to-moment basis. And as you do train and you go deeper with this, you'll find that there will be a level of wakefulness that doesn't go away. But it's not unless you've really trained yourself to remain. And so either you need to put in some hours on your meditation cushion or put some hours in on practicing presence before you begin to shift your wiring towards, oh, I'm coming home again. And so for a lot of people, if they don't make it a daily and regular thing, they'll lose the benefits they gain. You know, so I've taught for many years the 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction course and then 8-week mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression course. They were both originally pioneered by Jon Kabat-Zinn, 1979. They're great programs. They are a great way for people to learn skills. If they have a program that's an 8-week program near them, it's a great introduction to meditation. It's a great structured way to learn the practice. But if you don't keep it up, as marvelous as an experience will be, over time you'll begin to lose some of the benefit of it. And some people will lose a lot of the benefit of it if they don't practice it. Because
right.
practicing keeps training us how not to be so reactive. And how to not get so trapped and lost in the trance of our thought.
Yeah, yes. And there's a saying that I really like. It says, you know, meditate, and forgive me because I don't know who said it, and I probably should, but, you know, meditate for 20 minutes a day, and if you don't have enough time, then meditate for an hour a day.
Yeah. I've seen that too. And the idea is what they're saying in that is that, like, if you're so busy you can't even do 20 minutes, then you really need to do more than that, because it means that you're running your life at such a breakneck pace, that, you know, you're going to need a little bit more than 20 minutes, and you're going to need to really make changing the way that you're engaging the world different if you'd like to feel better.
Yes.
Because otherwise, the force of our habits will keep going until we run out of breath.
Yes, absolutely. I definitely agree. So we have about 5 minutes left. I feel like I could talk about this topic with you forever.
it's been fun, really, right? Great.
Yes, it's been really, really great. And I just want to make sure that people know, you know, if you are looking into meditation and you would like to try some out, Jeffrey has some available on his website for free download. And then you can also talk to him about teaching opportunities if you're wanting to find a teacher to help you with that. He's got classes and lots of things on his website. And then on Periscope as well, if you are not on Periscope, you can get on there. What's your name on Periscope?
Handle? Handle. It's the at sign. It's the at sign, and then it's just my name, at Jeffrey Rutstein. And that's where I am on. Right, that's where I am on Twitter and on Periscope, and I scope every morning. Poetry scope, which is really usually about ecstatic poems or poems about consciousness and presence, and sort of using them as portals to help people drop into presence. And then several times a week I do an evening scope on a topic about meditation or lead in meditation. And for folks interested too in learning about meditation, they can also check out Global Meditation Scope, which is going to be happening June 10th through 12th on Scope. And it's going to have 108 meditation guides from around the world over 2.5 days leading all different kinds of meditation. So it's kind of like a buffet lunch of meditation styles and features. So and people can find out more about that, in particular, by going to globalmeditationscope.com. It's a website, and it will list, as it gets closer to the event, the teachers and what times they'll be on and what styles of meditation they're offering. So it's really worth to download the app if you're interested in learning about meditation for that, and if they also want to follow me and some other people who teach on Scope already. But it's a great way to find out more about teachers.
I agree. And I think that, at least for me, listening to a guided meditation in the beginning was good, but then actually being able to be in a live scope with somebody and doing a meditation with others in a live atmosphere is much more powerful, in my opinion. I don't know how you feel about that.
I do too. I think that whenever we practice with other people, and if it's live, either online live or in person live, it's more powerful. I mean, of course, people can't always do that, and so you can't, but it's great to have that experience. For many years, I trained in a very rigorous tradition of Zen, Rinzai Zen, which is the more strict and militaristic venue or avenue of Zen. And we sat together, you know, hours at a time sitting together. And during intense periods, we would sit 14 hours a day for 7 days in a row. And you do this as a community in silence. And, you know, there's no way you could do that on your own. Not many people could, you know. But, you know, you're all doing this together. It actually helps you sit longer, be still longer. You know, otherwise, if you're on your own, you'll get up, you want to watch TV, you want to get a snack, you maybe want to lay down for a while. You'll find any reason to escape. And so sometimes it's just great power, even in shorter meditations, when it's done with a group. You benefit from the group.
Absolutely. I totally agree. So we are out of time. I hate to hop off because I feel like there's so much more to talk about, but I'm so, so grateful that you were able to join me tonight, Jeffrey. You have such a wealth of knowledge, and again, your presence, even over the phone, is just so great and peaceful. So I hope that anyone listening was able to get something from that. I'm sure they did, because it was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, Misty, this has been a pleasure. And I really enjoyed talking with you. And I really appreciate the invite to share this time.
Well, thank you so much. And you have a wonderful night, Jeffrey. I'm sure I'll see you on Periscope.
Sounds good to me, Miss.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us. Have a wonderful evening. And we will be back on Facebook. And we are talking with Sierra about ET consciousness. So stay tuned for that. Talk to you all later. Good night. Bye-bye.